You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. My guest today is Brendan Spieth. He's an actor, a jack of all trades. We went to Juilliard together, and he makes me laugh and gives me a lot of hope with his outlook on life. I hope you enjoy the fourth episode of The Compass. Thank you so much for being here.
You're so very welcome.
So what do you do when you feel yourself going to the dark side as an artist? And what is the dark side for you, Brendan?
It's a lot. I mean, the dark side is a groovy thing to think about. I was just telling Frankie, but when I get to the dark side, lately I've been taking more of a Louis C.K. approach to the whole thing of the dark side is always something that's going to be looming over the back of my shoulder, and I take that time to actually feel the hurt and pain and suffering of the dark side. Like, I mean, sometimes it comes knocking and you can let it go away, but there's sometimes it comes knocking very hard and is very persistent as a Jehovah's Witness and will ask you to let him or her in. And most of the times I like to let it in and just feel my feelings of what I am imagining to be the worst pain of all time. And then I like coping with the dark side by voicing that feeling of, like, I let that dark passenger in, and then I voice it to a good friend of mine, or, you know, my mom or my sister, and it's suddenly all the time, 100% of the time, I feel the feelings, I let the dark passenger in, I voice it to someone I love, and it becomes immediately smaller than it was before, you know? The imagination takes hold and it becomes this unsurmountable thing, and then you voice it and it becomes something so easy to throw away for me. It's like there was a Winnie the Pooh movie I used to watch when I was a kid, and someone like Rabbit or Piglet gets lost. I think it's Piglet, probably is. And Piglet gets lost, and in this, like, rock formation that looks like a skull, and they get so scared, and they're freaking out, and they finally get their courage together, and they go into the skull, and some other stuff happens, and there's, of course, some Heffalumps and Woozles and things like that, and they conquer this fear, go in, find Piglet, come out, and when they come out of the skull, they look back and they see it, and it's so small, and they're like, oh my god, I thought this isn't the same place. It used to look like this scary troll devil thing that, wait, this is the same place we just went into? And I always think of that image of it becoming smaller once you have let it in, experienced it, voiced it to someone, and it's so easy to shake off after that.
Have you found, I know that it, for me, like, there was a time when I didn't realize that I would face the dark side so often as an actor.
Yeah.
And that I didn't realize for a little bit, I began to realize the cycle of, like, I feel this anxiety or I feel this doubt, and it will run its course and it will pass.
Right.
Do you feel like you've come to that realization about voicing it to people, and that you have a system for working through it, like, over time, or has this kind of always been your perspective on it?
It's come over time, because at first, you know, when you leave school and everything's, you have an idea of where you should be at, and feel like a lot of, and especially going, like, both of us coming from Juilliard, like, you have such a high expectation for yourself to come out and, like, start hitting that pavement and booking shows, and then even shittier than that, people actually make that happen. Like,
right.
You know, you felt that coming out of school. Like, there are some classmates that you have that were just booking jobs right out of the gate, and you're like, fuck.
It's possible.
It's possible.
I see it.
It's not a fucking pipe dream. It's like people come out and they're, you know, people are coming out making, booking these shows. Oh my God, I got these agents and these managers and this guy wants to talk to me and this guy. And then, you know, you get your folder and it's three pages deep of people who kind of want to see you. And you start comparing yourself and that age old thing of like, oh, I'm being compared to, you know, I'm comparing myself to my peers and my classmates, which is a dangerous path to go down. And I remember feeling that sadness after school, right when everybody got their folders. And, you know, again, mm-hmm. the thing I play in my head is probably not as scary as it was, but I kept seeing, you know, my classmates coming up with stacks of folders and two folders full of all of these things, people wanting their headshot. And then when, you know, Kathy Hood gave me my folder, it was legitimately three pieces of paper, and feeling inadequate and feeling less than or something I had done wrong. And so through the years, I have developed this sort of, not system, but this way of just dealing with that feeling of inadequacy, of feeling lesser than or comparing myself to my peers and my classmates. And it's something you have to work at, and something I continue to work through. Like, maybe I shouldn't feel my feelings so hard, or maybe I should do it, you know, I should find other outlets for my stress and anxiety and depression. And, you know, you find things that work for you, and whether, like, my girlfriend goes to yoga a lot, and she loves to run and all of these, like, physical activities. I like to take dance classes right now is my big thing at Ailey. Go and take, like, a dance class and, you know, amazing. Like, sweating it out. Yeah, it's really great. And, like, you'll find things, and then some things don't work the second time. You know, one thing works another. You're just always finding your way, but it's an acquired behavior of facing this gigantic world of rejection and fear and self-doubt and all of these terrible things that you imagine in your head. And again, once you voice them, they kind of dissipate, but once they're in there, it's just very, it's a gigantic thing that seems unsurmountable, but once you're Winnie the Pooh and you leave the Skull Rock, it is so, so small, and it's so minuscule, and I hope that's answering the question.
Yeah,
like it's, totally. It's like a thing you keep relearning of how to deal with that sad little dark side.
Well, that's partly why I'm hoping this podcast will be helpful, because I think it's good just to talk about it.
Yeah, because then you talk about it, because once you voice it to friends, and especially friends who are in the industry, like, they will tell you how unhappy they are. Most 99% of the time, if you talk to an actor friend and you tell him the angst you're feeling of, like, not getting this audition or not booking that role or feeling like shit or comparing yourself, they have the same problems, or they have the same fears, or the, you know, the same thoughts. And that sense of communion is super important, because you're all in this together in a way. And the most dangerous thing you can do is not go to someone else, or, like, stay in your own little corner. And the most helpful thing I do is just talk and hang with people who may have the same feelings or have had them years before.
Right, at some point. Mm-hmm. You mentioned talking to your mom and your sister. Are they artistic at all, or do they, how do they process this strange world tell them about?
They're so very funny, because I'm the only artist who have come out of my family who is, I don't think, none of my brothers were in plays, or I think my youngest brother, Tamim, like, he's almost 40 now. Brian, he used to play the piano. It's about as good as we get. But my mom used to be a baton twirler. My sister has started doing things like gardening, and she does some pottery, which she's terrible at, and we'll say that to anyone, but, you know, she has a couple of artistic things, but I'm the only one who is really artistically inclined to make it actually a profession.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But do you find when you talk to them about it, how do they understand where you're coming from? Or are they just totally in the dark but willing to listen?
You know, I am the most lucky human in that all of my parents and close family have been very supportive in my endeavors. And not necessarily coming from a point where they can, like, understand what's going on or, you know, have, you know, be like, oh, yeah, I was in this place. I don't know. They just are so supportive in that, like, you know, when I was writing letters to be accepted in college and things like that, they would read over and want me to, they always want the best. And they're really groovy to hear my stories and give what input they can. And we're all very clear about, like, okay, this is your point of view, this is what you think, and this is how I'm gonna go about it.
Right.
They're just really great as being, they're just great, great listeners, my family. And they'll listen to it, offer what they can, and then go through. It's just super supportive. I think my family has been very, like a rock that I feel very steadied by. Just because they listen, I don't think it's not out of experience, it's just because they're good
people.
That's
wonderful. You know? Have they gotten to come and see much of your work in the city post-school?
Yeah. My brother, DJ, he lives in Chicago, and he gets to travel a lot for business, so he gets to come and see projects that I've been in and out of through school. And then I was fortunate enough to do a play in my hometown, San Antonio, a few years after I graduated. And so my family came and supported then. My mom has come as many times as she can. She came to this project. I had choreographed some dances at NYU about 3 years ago, and she came out to see that. She came to see a play I was in Vermont. You know, they're very supportive, and even when they're not there, they are very involved in, like, how's the rehearsal going? We like to talk through, like, different projects that I'm involved. They're very, like, they very want to just, they always pick up where we left off in phone conversations of, like, oh, wait, what's going on with this? What's going with, you know, Lesser America? What's happening with band play and those Lost Boys? My mom got to see those Lost Boys. Now she ever asks about is like, where am I going to get that rock, paper, scissors song? You know, she always wants that on her iPod. So, yeah, it's been really nice to have, especially when my mom comes out, it's really super awesome. It's so great. That's she really great. Is just, I could do anything. I could just, like, I could wear a dress and, you know, scream at the top of my lungs for 3 hours and she'll find something beautiful and amazing about it, so.
Well, since we're all kind of, since we kind of have to live in New York or LA, mm-hmm. that's what we tell ourselves. It's hard for a lot of our families, I know, to be involved like that. So that's wonderful that she can.
Yeah, and they see it as a little treat, you know. That's what I like about it. As sad as it is to be away from your family, your day-to-day life is so precious to them. And they, like, my brother Brian always calls and he's like, have you been to Gray's Papaya? I just can't. Like, this was maybe 5 years ago. He had a couple of hot dogs at Gray's Papaya, and every time he's always asking, like, you going down to Gray's Papaya? Oh my God, if I lived there, I'd take that amazing subway. He, like, brags about the subway. He's like, I think that's the most amazing thing anybody could have ever invented. Even though it's, like, the biggest trial and tribulation of our life of, like, you know, frustration in the subway. He loves that. And, you know, it's a treat to them to come and experience that life. And it's fun to share that life with them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is there anywhere that you, do you have like a little secret, well, if it's too secret, then don't share it. A little secret sanctuary in the city. What are some of your favorite places to go when you really want to feel at home or if you need to like get a positive attitude again? I know, like, I like to go like hang out in the MoMA sculpture garden and read or something or write in my journal.
Yeah. Yeah. There's so many, and they evolve over time. A lot of them always have to do with food for me. I have my favorite little restaurant bar. It is called, wow, this is so funny, I can't remember. It's called Freeman's Alley. You ever been to Freeman's?
No.
It's a restaurant that is off of Rivington Street, and it's in this, like, secret little alley. I don't go there often, but I love to go there when I'm feeling like if I want to reward myself for getting a job or want to have a nice dinner, I go there. A friend of mine opened my eyes to how beautiful it is to go into really big churches in New York City, even though I'm not very religious and neither is she. Like, just to listen to organ players. Huh. That's something I like to do, is to, like, go into a church when they have an organ player playing, just sit in the pews and listen.
That's such a great idea, because I do that if I'm traveling in Europe or stuff. Of course, I go see all these beautiful churches, but I never think to go inside in New York City.
No, and there's so many churches that just have this guy just practicing, and there's nothing happening. Like, pardon me, there's no like sermon going on, but it's such a vast and beautiful space filled with this amazing instrument that is so. You can't, like, haul an organ around on the subway and busk, you know. It's an instrument that has been built into the building, and it's something about that makes me feel so wonderfully small, and helps me reflect on what's actually going on, makes me work out the things I want to work out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think of you as kind of a Renaissance man since we've graduated school.
Yeah.
And I know you've got your fingers in all kinds of pies,
mm-hmm.
literally. tell me a little bit about all these different things you've gotten involved in that you've been kind of patchworking your artistic life with. I know you just mentioned food and music, which are both things I would love to talk about.
Yes. Oh, so many great things. I guess the most recent thing that has been a huge part of my life is cooking, a lot about food. And I guess that all started the summer I moved to Brooklyn with our good friend Gabriel Ebert and our other good friend Nathan Charles Miller. I guess I should have said Gabriel Quinn Ebert if we're going to do middle names. I'm Brendan Craig Spieth, you know. We all got three names. And anyway, we moved to Bushwick, and we had signed up for a community farm share, a CSA, and we had, like, all pitched in some money, and every week we would get fruits, vegetables, and flowers from this local farm in Long Island. And the first few weeks were really groovy, and we were like, oh, my God, these vegetables. But after a couple of weeks, it keeps coming in, and you're like, I don't know what I'm going to do with all these veggies and these fruits. All of these veggies and fruits are coming in. We have this book called The Farmer's Kitchen, which we're trying to, like, figure out how to cook kohlrabi. What is that? We're looking through the thing, and like, how do you keep it? All the stuff is going bad, and we felt really guilty because some vegetables would just start rotting in our fridge. We had to throw them out. And so at the same time all these veggies are pouring in, I came off a job in Vermont. I did my first equity show, The Aliens, out there, and came back, and the whole, you know, age-old question of like, all right, time to get a job, like a side job. And instead of waiting tables, I just lied on this interview for to cook at a bed and breakfast. And they knew I was lying. I'm sure they must have known I was lying about my experience beforehand. I showed up, and I just started, like, developing menu items just off the top of my head.
Did you have to cook to get the job? Did you have to,
like, no, cook I just had to sample? Describe things that I had cooked in the past, which is, like, easy. All right, I have this farm share. You know, I'm cooking all this wild shit already. So, like, you know, that's, oh, man, that's impressive. What is kohlrabi? So I'd gotten this job, and I happened to have a really great resource of my my brother Brian, who actually went to culinary school, asking him questions of, like, what kind of knives do I have in my bag?
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, he actually went, but he fixes airplanes now, so I cook in kitchens more than he does, which is why, you know, that's just our family. We're just a bunch of ragtag hoodlums, you know? And, you know, from there, I'd cooked for about a year and a half at this bed and breakfast. I'd gotten my food handler's license. I'd shadowed a couple of days at other restaurants, this great place called Boqueria. I got some experience there just shadowing for one day. And then I got another equity gig, and so I got to put that behind and then come back. And then the age-old question of, like, when are you going to get your side job? And so, like, food had already built up my resume, and I'd gotten this beautiful job at this restaurant called Egg in Williamsburg. And
I'm still sad I never visited when you were working there. I still have never eaten there.
Oh, it's such a fun place. It's such, I mean, it really was a diamond in the rough to find because I had applied through that job via Craigslist, which is, you know, always a crapshoot. And usually when you go shadow or trail on a restaurant from a Craigslist thing, it's a terrible, terrible feeling. But Egg was looking for a prep cook, which is a very easy, it's like the lowest of the totem pole to do. And they needed someone specific enough to, like, do the allotted amount of work and the allotted amount of time and the allotted amount of space. And all of it was small. I mean, the space was so, so small and the work was so, so large because they, you know, are feeding so many people every day. Anyway, I'd gotten the job through Egg. I told the guy who had trailed me, I said, please, please, please give me this job. I really need. He's like, you're okay, man. We're all right. We're going to hire you. Don't worry. I've got you. And, you know, at that time I had gotten the job at Egg, my agency I was signed with out of school had dropped me via email.
Ooh.
Which was, yeah, it was a terrible time. Like, guys. Yeah, and it wasn't you. Even like, it wasn't even like a subtle thing. Like, I opened the email and was like, oh my God, it actually said in the subject heading, Brendan Spieth termination.
Oh my goodness.
Which, you know, they had called me afterwards and they were like, oh my God, we are so sorry. This was totally an oversight. And I was like, yeah.
Oh no, it was like the draft they had written.
Yeah, exactly. Or something they felt like it was an oversight. I think it was just something that they had, like, you know, they have this whole. Either way, whatever had happened, they had terminated me via email, and it was a terrible, terrible time. And I had gone into that dark place. I had become a permanent resident there, it had felt. And so, you know, I get this job, these beautiful people around me cooking this beautiful food. I felt kind of in a very frustrated place with my artistic career. And I just was like, okay, let's just take a break. I don't have an agent, so nobody's sending me out for auditions, so my life is my life. Let's just see where this goes. And it was a beautiful opportunity, man. What a beautiful opportunity to work. I think, like, my second shift I'd worked there was a Saturday brunch, which is always crazy at Egg, and we had lost a line cook. Somebody had quit working the line, which happens, and, you know, we're all frustrated, and usually what happens is, like, one person does two jobs. But at Egg, the owner, George Weld, had just woken up that morning. He's like, hey, I haven't worked the line for 5 years. I'm going to do it. And just stepped on the line and started, you know, he was on the flat top. He was working the flat top like a G. I couldn't believe it. And to see the thing that made me feel so good is to see a guy who didn't need to do that, didn't have to do that, could have, you know, fucked off and let us figure it out, like, step up and help us out and feel that sense of camaraderie. It was very similar to what you feel in a theater, to what you feel when you're working with an ensemble on a show, or, you know, like how my class related to each other as an ensemble. And so I was so attracted to that sense of camaraderie of, like, we all stepped up, we all worked our hardest, and we made some beautiful food. And they taught me a lot about Southern American rustic cooking. Yeah, I had learned how to, like, transfer fat, transfer stock, how to braise bacon, how to cook chicken, how to break a chicken down, how to use the bones for stock, how to responsibly and efficiently use animals to with cooking with them. And, you know, instead of just, like, buying chicken breast at the supermarket, you're buying a whole chicken and, like, using every ounce of that animal to its full potential, and how delicious that could all be. Such a beautiful, beautiful place, and their philosophy on cooking and eating and food and community was so, like, just, and was enveloped in that love, you know. And so through working at Egg, I had known a gal named Emily Simonas, who runs this not-for-profit called Space and Rider Farm. It's an artistic residency that houses painters and dancers and writers and actors. She had gotten wind of, you know, my cooking at Egg, and we were friends beforehand. And then she poached me to come cook one day in Rider Farm, which then took flight. And then I cooked a month the next year, and then took flight, and I helped them start some of their food program in 2015. And so, like, through that, I guess cooking has kind of, like, erupted from one little bed and breakfast job to cooking an egg for a little while, and then, like, their head chef poached me to go to their sister restaurant to work at Parish Hall, and I learned how to break down ducks and, like, saw meat bones. And then we did, like, pig demonstrations where, like, Evan is slinging a whole pig on the prep table, and we're learning about, like, loin and chops and, like, how breaking down an entire animal and, like, a lot of cool stuff that I'm sure if this was 100 years ago, and we still had radio and podcasts, but if this was 100 years ago, we would all know how to do this stuff, how to preserve all of this meat. And so I had taken that break from acting to learn another skill that I think is very important to living your life as a responsible human. Like making stock, making food, because food is such an important part, like even more important than theater, is what we eat.
Yeah.
Like, because you can't live without eating, so why not learn about how to feed yourself in the most nourishing, healthy, and efficient, economical, lovely, beautiful, and artistic way. And food, for me, still continues to be a way of expressing myself and, like, where I come from, where I've been. Because you think of, like, Mexican traditions of... I love the idea of the tortilla. We talk about the tortilla and how, like, bread and, like... I don't know how to explain it, but, like, I come from Texas. I'm from San Antonio. Tacos were given to me from birth. And, like, understanding, like, how using that tortilla to lap up all of the beautifulness that is in an egg or in a meat or in a sauce. And, like, I can use my knowledge and my past and things that are important to me, like tacos, because... Let's get real. You know, I can cook a taco in a very specific way or personal way that tells the story of where I've been. Or like...
I see.
Yeah, yeah.
I see the storytelling link there.
Yeah, the storytelling link of... Or I used to work at a bar restaurant called Livingston Manor, which was an amazing experience, learning experience for me. We were working on how to use the littlest, simplest ingredients to feed people at a bar. And my friend Maud and I had started just researching, like, bar food. And we came to, I think our staple was the deviled eggs. Deviled eggs everybody ordered all the time. And instead of just slapping them on the plate, Maud would show me how to place these eggs and drizzle it with, you know, a balsamic reduction and have this plating. And people would get this plate of deviled eggs, which is
at,
like,
the bar.
At the bar, and they would be mesmerized by how beautiful it was and the beautiful presentation of this food. You look at all these colors and it excites your stomach in a very amazing way, and you eat this food and it becomes a whole experience. I love making deviled eggs. You know, what a great little thing. And our pickles were featured in New York Magazine.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
I didn't know that.
I can say that now. I'm like, my pickles were featured in New York Magazine. Like a cool. It was for pickles, you know, picklebacks, you know, when you take a shot of whiskey and then pickle juice. They were, like, doing a whole feature on, like, Livingston Manor, just pickleback juice. But, yeah, our brine was featured in New York Magazine.
That's amazing.
It's a cool thing. I love learning about food and everything, I think... We'll talk about what I like to do. I've always kept at the forefront of, like, expressing, using these tools to express. And that has kept me happy from going into that dark.
Even when you are using it as a money job sometimes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, cooking never pays you very well, even if you're the sous chef or the head chef. It's wild how little money those people in this industry make. You know, acting is a whole thing, but cooking, I mean, people work so hard for $11 an hour. It breaks my heart because these people who are the dishwashers or who are the busboys work even harder than I did as a prep cook. And they would say, you know, Julio or Jesus would tell me, like, you know, I go after this, I clock out, I have an hour to myself, and then I go to another bar and I work a full-time dishwashing job there. And they have families and everything to support. And, you know, so, again, food, you know, when you go to that's how I was making money, was having this food in front of me and making all of this stuff. And in that, when the chefs or the sous chefs would be like giving you little tips on technique or little tips on how you can make the presentation of a dish being expressive, it was a great outlet for sort of that creative angst I had been holding back because I'm not getting auditions. I'm not going out to, you know, I'm not going out and doing plays like some of my classmates. It was a really helpful way of just like having another expressive outlet.
Yeah.
You know,
that's wonderful. Did you find it kind of a nice change to be around people who are so immersed in a different community, in a different world?
Yeah.
Because I feel like we spend so much of our time around other actors, which is great, but it's, everyone's only obsessed with that world.
It's insular.
And those issues.
But what you, the thing that was cool about working in the kitchen is that a lot of the guys and gals who cooked on the line had passions that they would talk about when we go to the bar. You know, we go to the Levee after work, and we go to the Levee and grab a Sportsman, and, you know, I'll sit in the back, and, you know, this guy named Jawe I cooked with, he would talk about, you know, he taught martial arts, and he would talk about all of the things in the worlds I didn't know about martial arts, and he would get so specific. And then you would go to the other guy, Matt Carmona, and that guy was a writer who would always recommend books to all of us, and we started a book club. We were reading Confederacy of Dunces for a while. Like, he would get the whole, you know, the kitchen to read. A lot of great stories and a lot of great passions, and it made me feel like they would get excited about, I had auditioned for The Winter's Tale at the Globe around the time I was cooking at Egg, and they called me in the kitchen for this thing, and they were saying, you know, we need you for this callback tomorrow, we need you at this time. And I'm like, oh no, I'm cooking. And Matt Carmona come in, sweep up. He's like, I would love to take your prep shift from you. You know, like, it was an exciting thing. We were all trading passions at the time.
Yeah.
A lot of these guys who either have passion for food or passion for, like, literature or passion for martial arts, they were all in that thing. And it kept a nice open world for us to bounce ideas and dreams to each other. And a lot of them, some of them, a buddy of mine, Eddie, who is cooking in Chicago right now, most talented cook I've ever met in my life, and just him to talk about, like, you know, the food he wants to cook and how he wanted to, you know, fuse two cultures or three or four cultures together. And then, you know, we would share just little things. I'd show them, like, a little monologue or, you know, slip them a play, and then Eddie would share me a little menu that he was developing for this food truck. It's just like a little idea chamber of love for these people. So it was working with them outside of our insular community just made me realize how similar we all are in the passions that we all have, whether it be, you know, again, for martial arts or cooking or theater plays.
So tell me a little bit about music and how that's kind of taken over a lot of the stuff you've been doing, either from playing music or choreographing to music, like, since leaving school.
Yeah.
Like, you've been creating a lot of your own stuff.
Yeah. I've been fortunate enough to have given, after school, I was given free time and space. I had nothing to do. And after, you know, 21 years of having your whole life scheduled out for you in classes and English and math, and then it turns into acting and masks and movement and then voice and speech and all of these things that are planned out that you do and you do well, I had nothing. And I saw it at the time as a very big burden that I had to carry of, like, oh shit, I'm not doing anything. I'm not, my roommates are all doing Broadway plays and doing this, you know, the episode of The Good Wife. What the fuck am I doing? And
right.
And it gave me the chance of being like, well, what do you want to do, man? What do you want to do? And I got the opportunity to choreograph, you know, got to work with some dances and choreography through Jesse Perez, who is an amazing human being and a soul of just magnanimous multituded, like, what a guy, man. Had brought this dance to me, and he was like, I have this dance, I'm going to teach it to you, and then you're going to teach it to this cast. the cast of Bomb and Gilead that Brian Mertes and Alex Harvey and Bill Willimon had brought together to do in a warehouse in Sunset Park.
Which was wonderful. I remember that.
Yeah, what a great time. And so I got to spend the night in this warehouse for 4 or 5 nights and just do this dance. And then through that, choreography and like gestures and all of that had been an important part of just making work happen. What work is there? And through that, Alex Harvey poached me to do some stuff at NYU for this play called The Humans Are in Trouble. And I got to do some of my own moves after using, learning Jesse's moves and kind of go into my own body. And then, right now I'm working on a production of Peer Gynt that he's doing for the third year class at NYU. We're doing a couple of
that's
dances.
That's the undergraduate program?
No, that's the graduate program.
Really?
Yeah, third year grads.
Congratulations.
Oh, thanks. I
didn't realize it was the graduate.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It's the grads. And
is that open to the public?
Yeah. Y'all are totally invited. Anybody who listens to this, totally invited to see some Peer Gynt.
Do you know the dates?
I do believe it opens September 24th.
Okay. Good to know.
And I think it plays throughout that weekend. I could be wrong though, I'm just there in the building, man. It's Juilliard all over again, just different place.
I know, how funny to now be working at another program that's pretty much exactly the same.
Exactly the same.
Exactly the same. There's such great cats,
man. Everybody's so cool. So music has been, I guess I can say back to the original question of music, I was a musician before I was an actor. I played the trumpet in middle school and learned and loved music. And I wanted to be part of the Lee High School drumline in San Antonio. Wanted to be a...
Is that a huge deal in Texas? Like, is that playing in the football games and all that kind of thing? Or
since I can't play football, like, football would be where, like, the eye on the prize. You want to be quarterback. You wanted to be Nick Fanuzzi. Throwing the ball at so many yards, but I couldn't do that. So I wanted to be on the drum line. And at Lee High School, where I was supposed to go, and then at Churchill High School, where I did go, both drum lines were very, very intense. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be in snare. I wanted to be on the snare drum. Oh, I wanted to play snare drum so bad because, it's so fast and so snappy. It was the place to be because, you have to be rigorous on your rudiments and such. And about that time, I had been picked up for drama class. And so I had dropped the whole snare drum thing and gone to drama. And so picked up music, developing this project with Nick Choksi and Frankie Alvarez and Gabriel Ebert and Damon Dono and LB Yost, Melissa Kieveman. We'd all developed this project, this band play about this band we had invented called Those Lost Boys. And we started developing it around 2012. And Nick had come to me because he knew I'd played drums and we wanted a drummer for the band. And that project being dropped in our lap just unlocked this little musical beast I had been stowing away for another time. And again, to play with such great musicians like Elvie and Damon and Nick and Gabe, I mean, it's unreal. And so
to be playing drums, because I know you do a lot on guitar and ukulele and all this stuff, but to be doing drums,
drums, which is like the thing that you want to be doing, man. You to be a drummer is just to be the best of all of those music,
and you got to be in a band while in a play.
In a band, and I would tell Nick and Gabe, I'd be like, you're letting me live my dream, man. You're letting me live my dream. Like, what do you mean? I was like, be in a fucking band? Are you kidding me? Like, we're in a band. We go to the studio. We would like rehearse. And I would go to work. You were getting paid for this project. I'd go to work, and work was sitting behind a drum kit. What an unbelievable feeling. Of just to sit and that's, we're making work happen. This project has, it unlocked that. And I had never written a song before we had started Those Lost Boys in 2012. Yeah.
I didn't realize that was the first time you had.
I'd written stuff with Mertes' project kind of and done you know, some music stuff, but I'd never written a song cover to cover with my own, like, chord progression.
I love your songs.
Oh, thank you. They're super... It's given me the skill that I didn't know I could do. And I always would tell Nick, I was like, I wish I could write one like you do, man. Oh, mm-hmm. man. I wish I could write some songs. And this has given me the ability to just, like, sit and write and sketch and record and re-sketch and re-record and put pieces together and think of songs and how I hear them in my head and try to translate them down into how they come out of my mouth. Yeah, so we had done this, we'd gotten this project, all of us were songwriters, all of us could play the ukulele, all of us could do these things, so we would switch, you know, who took the hot seat at what certain point in the play. And I think that's what makes the project so fun and beautiful, is that everybody gets a chance to add their own little color to the picture.
Yeah.
Their own little voice. Yeah. And so,
and that's so, I mean, that's the thing that everyone wants to do, is to create their own work. And that was Nick's idea. And then you guys all,
yeah,
kind of made it together, wrote it together, wrote all the music.
Yeah, it kind
and
of,
you're
it
still
going
to be doing it sometime in the future, right?
You
I know
of course.
You've done it several times now, but you're still kind of moving forward at some point.
It's like a, it's like one of those poems you someone writes a line and then folds the paper, and then someone writes another line, and then you unfold the whole thing, and you see this beautiful piece. It happened that way, that Nick had an idea that was a trickle-down effect that all of us got on board for, and then all of us added our own little piece of that poem, and it's continually, it's something we always work out, we're always working out. And then this music, from trying to accomplish the story of the play, we're trying to, like, pinpoint the timeline of this, these musicians, we've developed, like, I think it's a White Album's worth of music.
Oh my goodness.
Beatles White Album's worth of music. I think maybe we're even one more song above that. We have about, like, yeah, I want to say, like, close to 30 some odd songs, right? Something
yeah.
like that. It's stupid. It's stupid how many songs we have and how many songs we haven't even played in the show that are part of the story that we've built. So yeah, lately it's been just loads of music. And then through that, people are giving me instruments to, like, look after while they're gone doing a show, and it'll just, like, pawn off these instruments. And so now my roommate Nate freaks out about just how many, goddamn, how many banjos. I have a trumpet in my room now, two tenor banjos, one five-string banjo, three acoustic guitars, a bass guitar, a couple of amps. It's just like being pawned off.
I picture your room being like kind of a magical junk, like junk shop.
Yeah, yeah, it's like a magical junk shop.
Where there are secret little things behind
all
the
like,
doors.
I had to like pseudo loft my bed because I'm not that hipster anymore. But you know, I've got like a little pseudo loft, and then underneath that loft
all
is where all the instruments, all the bodies are.
You
hidden,
need to write
know?
A play about what's under that bed.
Yeah, right under the bed. Here
yes.
are the instruments, the nasty little.
Or a
little
short film.
Yeah, right.
What's under
filming
there?
The. But it that was a beautiful gift that Nick gave to all of us. He didn't, not trusted, but more like believed that we all could do it. And then it just followed suit. He had this dream in his head about what this play could be, and wanted these people, and brought us all together. And like, it really just had us all challenge each other to adapt to other voices. It's really quite wild how...
Right.
versatile a songwriter we've all become since we have entered this project. Like, I can say for every single band member, and Frankie too, like, all of us have just become better writers and people because being around each other and like challenging each other to do the things that we know the other one can do. We can dream the other one writing this song, and then they do, and it's so cool. What a cool thing.
No, I love that project. It's so inspiring watching you guys make it.
Oh,
I love that you've been working on so many things in a lot of different places through a lot of, I assume, you know, working on one thing, someone sees it, someone asks you to do something else. But then I also know the frustration with the agent situation and like the legit auditions. How do you feel like you're navigating between those waters? Like you're having this, a lot of these beautiful artistic experiences, and you're paving your own way on that side. But I'm sure it's frustrating to not have that the more structured kind of actor life, well, with like the business side of it. Have you kind of like come to terms with that being the current reality? Are you less interested in like working with that kind of, I don't know what I'm asking.
I totally get, I actually get what you're asking of like,
working within the system as opposed to working without the system.
Out of the system. Yeah.
Maybe that's a better way to put it.
That makes total sense. Like the system of, or what I understand of like, your agent gives you a call and says, I want you for this audition here at Lincoln Center. Right. Daniel Sweet is going to see you. And he never does. But like, you know, Daniel Sweet is going to come and see you and you're going to audition and hopefully book the parts of the thing. They're 10% commission and you can go out to the Old Globe and do your thing. And that's all fine and dandy. But I guess the frustration happens and I feel inadequate. Again, the dark passenger comes knocking all the time, and I think about that, like, man, I'm not, you know, my roommate Nate goes out for auditions. It's not the same thing for me. I don't get the call. I don't get the breakdowns as much, and I was trying to, let me see if I can pull it up. Trying to tell Frankie, and we were looking at this drawing of a box. There's a scientist, it's a drawing of a cube. And the scientist explains that the cube can be seen from two different angles. You look at the cube, and you see one cube with the box's face pointed towards the right of you, and then if you look at it another way, the front of the box or cube will be going to the left. And it all has to do with perception. And this guy talks about flipping between these two points of view. Yeah. And so I think of it as like, I've got my frustrated point of view and I've got my, holy shit, I'm doing things point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that it can be flipped. That's one thing I try to tell myself all the time is like, look back at what you've actually done and look back at what like work you have created and generated. And then I try to do a little positive comparison of like artists and athletes and people I respect, and I look at their paths, and one that I like to talk about is this athlete I love named Danny Green. And Danny Green is he's an amazing player, and he's one of the starting five for the San Antonio Spurs.
Mm-hmm.
And Danny Green used to play for the Cleveland Cavaliers with LeBron James, 2006, I think. He played, and he was on the team, and then he got traded, and Coach Popovich, coach of the San Antonio Spurs title-winning team, D-leagued his ass. Put him in the development league after playing for the NBA and getting like NBA money, said, no, wow. You're going to pay cut. You're going to the D league. You got to figure it out. Not only did he do that, he did that twice.
Jeez.
Twice to a guy who'd been playing the NBA. And Danny Green was D league twice and he went and he worked his ass off. And now he is a starting player and one of the most phenomenal three point shooters in the NBA.
Hmm.
And so I think if Danny Green can like look at his situation and accept the fact that he is in the development league and actually work his ass off, like, I can do that. So I think about Danny Green a lot. And I also like to look at other artists who have points in their careers that have dipped. Like, I look at Tom Waits and his whole artistic timeline and how he had, Tom Waits wrote a bunch of songs for a bunch of other artists. I don't know if you knew this, but, mm-mm, like, he wrote Old 55 on Closing Time, and that was covered by the Eagles and made super famous. He also wrote Jersey Girl, which is a Bruce Springsteen song that is super like, rah, rah, rah. And he wrote that song. And Tom Waits like stuck so true to his guns that he turned down a deal for Sears. Like, Sears wanted to buy a song of his, and he said, no, I don't want to be that. I don't want to be that guy who you put in a suit and like dress up and XYZ. He stuck so true to who he was, and it went into like, you know, like this financial rabbit hole, this whole depressive rabbit hole of like not being a Billboard artist. And look at him now. I just like to look at things in perspective, I guess, is the point I'm getting at. I like to look at artists who have dropped off the face of the planet and had, you know, had a developmental career like Danny Green, and like I feel like I'm doing right now. And I can look back right now and say, like, I made that happen. I made this happen. I worked for what I wanted to do, and it doesn't pay, but who really gives a shit at the end of the day? gets a paycheck. I can get that from a bar. I can get that from, you know, teaching a class. Like, the paycheck, it doesn't matter. I mean, it does, but it doesn't. As long as I'm doing the things I want to do. That's what matters. It was like, and those people inspire me, man. Those people really inspire me. Danny Green inspires me. Jim Houghton inspires mm-hmm. me, man. What an inspirational human being. Actors, man. Steve Buscemi used to be a firefighter. You know, like, what the fuck? Who knows? Who knows yeah. when it's your time? And there's stories of actors who don't make it until they're, like, in their 60s.
That's true.
It's a marathon of a career, you know? And a lot of the time you go into that dark place worrying about where you've been or where you're going to go, but you rarely think about where you are at that certain point. And, like, where am I at now? What's around me? Who's around me? What's going on? How can I help? Is an approach I've always stuck true to. And, like, when it comes to my involvement with, like, Lesser America, mm-hmm. that's something that was just around me because Nate Miller was my fucking roommate, you know, and he's one of the founding members, and they were like, oh, we're putting on this play and we need some people to help build this set, you know? What is around me? What's happening? How can I help? So would I like to get more auditions? Of course. How can I do that? That's all on my own. And, like, I've fallen out of love with it, and, you know, when I started Cooking an Egg, like, said goodbye and didn't even want to trouble with it. And then, you know, more and more, and especially now, like, now it's time for me to, I want to ask the favors I need to ask and, like, make the things happen mm-hmm. that I need to make happen. And, you know, there's a lot of people that are so supportive. This community in New York City is so supportive that it's been so easy, or not so easy, but it is so easy to just ask, like, what's going on? How can I help?
That's a great America. Point
how
of
can
view.
I, yeah, yeah, right? You know, like, the representatives, how can I help? You know, all these people are making great theater. How can I help it help make it happen?
Yeah.
Has helped me keep a positive outlook on the whole bullshit that I don't get called in for work a lot. Again, flip-flop.
Yeah.
Looking at the cube a different way, I guess.
Are there any books or pieces of music or things that you find yourself turning to kind of take yourself out of that dark side, or things that you are like, oh, right, this is what's important?
There's so many things. Albums and things that I read that keep me...
Or that you just find yourself, like, going back to time and time again, and it kind of reorients everything.
I like to... Yesterday, I was listening to this old playlist I had. I had it around the time I had auditioned for Juilliard, and I remembered, holy shit, this song came on from the Sufjan Stevens album called Michigan. Mm-hmm. And I had listened to the song, and I was like, fuck, I used to listen to this song every audition I ever went into for college. I would listen to that before I would go into it. I think it's called, like, All the Naysayers Speak Up. Sufjan is someone I go to, and Chet Baker. I like to listen to Chet Baker Sings. Have you ever heard that album?
Mm-hmm.
There's this really amazing piece of literature. It's a preface that... it's Sidney Michaels who wrote it. It was a preface to this play Sidney Michaels had written called Dylan. It's about Dylan Thomas.
Hmm.
Anyway, the play is really great, but what's even better is the preface to the play, and it breaks down every sort of imaginative reason of why we show up to the theater to do what we do. And when I was in high school, I was with your classmate Anthony Wofford. Mm-hmm. He was a sophomore, I was a freshman, and we used to sweep the theater, we'd mop the theater, we'd pull up the wings, and we'd paint the whole floor black before our contest play part of the year, which was like after spring break, you know. we were doing a contest play, which in Texas, everything's so real. And they're like, yeah, you got to compete with everything. Like the same organization that organizes the football in Texas, like state, they organize this drama competition, UAL one act play.
Wow.
Yeah, it's super competitive. You cut a play down to 40 minutes. I know it sounds like sacrilege, but it's a thing they did. And you would cut down a play 40 minutes and you present it and people would judge it and you would advance or not advance. It's funny. I mean, that year we were doing Death of a Salesman, which we went to state. Goodness. I know, right?
Cut down.
To 40 minutes, which is sacrilege, but it was also something that was like, it taught me a lot, man, about doing the same fucking show. We did the whole, our stage manager had took down the notes we'd done it 160 some odd times with all the run throughs. Because we had done it, like, we would run it like twice every day.
It was so short.
You know, 40 fucking minutes. And we'd go through it and we'd give notes and, you know, trying to build it, trying to keep going there. And then you'd go to a competition, of course, put on your makeup. But before any of that shit ever happened, our teacher would have us paint the floor, bring it all down to neutral, and then focus the lights. And he would bring up all the lights to half, bring the house lights down, and we'd look on this empty theater. And he would just read, this preface to Dylan to us. And it's about the infinite possibility of an empty space of theater. And it's very, like, Peter Brook-esque, but also, like, made so many references of, like, Ibsen and Shaw and Moliere, and, like, would talk about certain things that can exist but do not yet exist in this space of the theater. And every now and again, like, every couple of years or so, I'll pull it out of my I'll pull it out of my folder and I'll read it and I'll cry, of course, because it's such a beautiful piece. But it always connects me to the, like, that, like, breath of a space before it becomes something. And I love it because, like, I'm sure, I mean, I know that Ibsen didn't know what the fuck he was doing until he did it. You know, Shaw, all these people didn't know that they had this, you know, Arthur right. Miller didn't know he had Death of a Salesman in him until he fucking wrote the play, you know. Same could be for us, man.
Mm-hmm. I can't wait to read it.
Yeah. it's a cool, yeah, Preface to Dylan by Sidney Michaels. It's cool. I'll try to see if I send you a copy. I'm just more of the ilk of a guy. I'm like a guy who listens to albums over and over and over until, you know, the needle has worn the groove mm-hmm. out. And I'll go through phases of, like, you know, through undergrad, it was all Radiohead. Now it's like all Loudon Wainwright, and right now it's this guy named Joe Williams. I don't know if you know who Joe Williams is, but
no.
One of the best tenors of all time. Okay. Used to sing with Count Basie. Count Basie swings and Joe Williams sings. And right now, I guess if I had to put you in my mind right now, the song I can't stop listening to is a song called It's the Talk of the Town by Joe Williams. Oh! It's on this beautiful album cover. It's got him. It's like in blue. Like there's like some sort of what you would say now, like Instagram filter of blue. You get this blue filter that he's seen through, and he's got this amazing turtleneck, and he's looking up at the sky, and it says, "A man ain't supposed to cry." Such a great album. has a song called "It's the Talk of the Town." I cannot stop listening to. My girlfriend like hides the record from me because it's so great.
Is there anything that you've seen lately that you'd like to recommend? Any plays or friends things?
I did walk here. I got off at the Steinway stop because I took the wrong train because it's Queens and it confuses me. And I got out at Steinway on the R train and I saw a poster for a new show by this guy named James Theree.
Okay.
James Theree is Charlie Chaplin's grandson. And he's a theater artist and quite kind of around the ilk of like Orlando Pabotoy and like Chris Bay's very clown physical movement. Moni Yakim would lose his shit over this guy. He's a physical theater maker.
And he's making the show or he's starring in it? Or
he stars in his shows and he writes them and he choreographs them. And like.
And this is a play that's happening.
Yeah, it's a play he wrote. But the last... I didn't remember what it was called because I was just freaking out that he's back because I saw him do this show called Raul, maybe four or five years ago. And I'd spent a ridiculous amount of money to see this show, because I was going through this chaplain thing at the time, and it was unreal what that show was. And it was just him and another guy, and the other guy was a puppeteer, and he made all these like puppets come to life. And then it was James Theory like playing violin, like concert violinist level violin, and just doing all of these motions. And he had this great moment, which I'm sure he'll do something of that ilk in this new show, but he had this moment where he's levitating in the theater and spinning around in this black, everything's black except for him. He's got this headlamp on, he's levitating and flying over the audience. And of course, you know, very Fuerza Bruta kind of style of like, what the fuck is actually happening? And then he does this beautiful thing where the lights, he had the lights switched on and the theater lights showed the apparatus that was making him levitate and flip and turn, and the two dudes who were operating it. And made it even more magical to me to like see this thing. And then he reveals it, and then it was just unbelievable. And I haven't seen the show yet, but his new show at BAM that's going to happen, I think it's September 30th it opens.
Okay.
I know that it would, I mean, he was just, it was.
I'm glad you told me, because I'm sure it's like a limited thing, right?
That's the dream, man. That's the dream. You could give me as many TV shows as you want to give me, but like what that guy is doing is the dream. It's so good. It just makes you forget about everything, and you believe in magic in a very real way. And even when he reveals the trick, it's still a gift of love, and it's so wild. And the guy, he doesn't even say anything in the whole show. And it's like, it's all pantomime. And his mom, who's Chaplin's daughter, like sews all the costumes.
Oh
and,
my like, goodness!
It's a cool little affair.
Okay, I got to do my research. Yeah.
James Theory, that's man, amazing. He's unbelievable. And he comes every like 3 or 4 years to BAM.
Okay.
Does a show. Oh my god, he's unbelievable. So good.
Brendan, thank you very, very much.
You're so very, very welcome.
Bye.
Bye. Where the river leads, I am from these trees, don't you cut me down. My wobbly knees, and I'm scared to speak. Atop these peaks, my love is a songbird with a tiny beak. I am from mountains. I am from snow. I am from temple, where the winds blow. I am from mountain. I am from snow. I am from temple, where I'm a clock tower boy, time lives within my violin. And if you try to take the water from the lake, you're left with families broken. And I am from mountain, I am from snow, I am from temple, where the winds blow. I am from mountain, I am from snow, I am from temple, where the winds blow. And this is my home, and this is my home, and this is my home, and this is my home.
longer own.
I wrote that song. So I am from Mountain. I wrote that song for, I was teaching with A-Step at a program called RISA, with a group called IRC, all great people involved in this. But I was filling in for an art class and we had written I Am From poems. These kids were refugees from Tibet, Nepal, India, all parts of the world. And they just moved to New York City and they were just getting acclimated to the school system of the United States. And so we wanted them to talk about where they're from, what part. And we were like, well, you're not from, like, I'm from Nepal, I'm from Tibet. No, that's not that. Like, what things remind you of home? Like, things that would speak to you. And it can be, I am from spicy, I am from these. And they spoke these words of, I am from these things. And all of them echoed him. I don't know. It just touched me in a very real way that they had left this place that they call home, and all of these images of like temples and mountains and snow and spicy foods. Like, we all joked about how we're all from spicy because I love spicy foods too. And like, but these kids were just speaking from their heart in this language that they barely knew. And it was so pure. It was the purest thing. And I just sat and wrote the song. Groovy, right?
Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. I'm Leah Walsh. More episodes are coming soon. Please look for us on Facebook and iTunes. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brendan Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.